طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we will finish up our presentation of the report back by Nancy and Hubert Murray and the Reverend Mariama White Hammond. Last week we featured presentations by Nancy and Hubert Murray, and this week we feature the Reverend Mariama White Hammond, followed by a very rich discussion and answer period. This was a particularly insightful report back because of the historical perspective offered by this particular delegation. The Reverend Mariama White Hammond is an advocate for ecological and social justice, youth engagement, and spirit-filled organizing. As former director of Project Hip Hop, Highways into the Past, History, Organizing, and Power, she used the arts as a tool to raise awareness for social issues from juvenile incarceration to funding for public transportation. Reverend Mariama is very committed to engaging the faith community, and particularly the Black Church, on climate change and ecological justice issues. She presently serves as the pastor of the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Here is the Reverend Mariama White Hammond speaking at Boston University about her trip to Palestine on a delegation with Nancy and Hubert Murray, followed by a question and answer discussion.
So this was not my first trip. I went in 2015, and the reason that I'll start is that I grew up and I went to school like half mile from here at the Windsor School. It was an all-girls school. And good percentage of my school was Jewish, and we were right down the street from Temple Israel. And so I've grown up with deep relationships and connections to the Jewish community. And I remember when Yitzhak Rabin was killed, there one of the students at my school was speaking about it, and another student that I also knew called her a Zionist. The two of them got into a deep argument, and I was like, I don't know what's going on here. And so I started to learn a little bit more about Israel, about Israeli history, about the formation of the State of Israel. And then I also remember I worked a lot in hip-hop culture and working with young people around hip-hop, and remember hearing from a lot of Palestinian hip-hop artists who were describing conditions that I was familiar with, and then also conditions that were even worse than what I was used to in terms of issues with the police and issues with folks just trying to survive and live doing the basic things that human beings need to do. And so in 2015, I had the opportunity, I was a student at the School of Theology, and there was a trip called Dual Narratives, and I had been offered opportunities before that, but I really wanted to take a trip that allowed me to really look at both perspectives on how, you know, how people saw what was going on, and a real attempt to understand, like, what's at the foundation of this. So we read a book that's, you know, I recommend if you want to. It's called Side by Side, and it's half the book is written by Jewish history or Israeli history teachers who are all Jewish in this particular instance, and Palestinian history teachers. And when they say side by side, it's literally side by side. Like, so one page is one narrative, then the other page is the other narrative. You can't read it across. You have to just kind of read a whole chapter and then go back and read the whole other chapter. But and so it was really powerful for me because as a person who comes from an oppressed group, I have this deep question about, like, how can a group that has been so deeply oppressed also participate in the oppression of another group? And that was really the question I needed to grapple with. And I would say that first trip in 2015, and I went to a lot of the places that we visited, but also some that we didn't. And I was heartbroken. I remember one particular experience, and I would say the first thing I would say is that I deeply understood the Jewish desire for a homeland. So I just want to be really clear as a person, as an oppressed person who lives in a country where you're not always sure whether the nation that you've spent your whole life in will have your back when the rubber meets the road. I understand what it is to want a place where you know that the people there will, where your life will matter. Where if all goes wrong, you have some place to go. I get it. And so the question was, a homeland, but at what price? And I remember one of the incidents that I think most I remember is, you know, I'm a knitter. I would have been knitting if I wasn't, you know, making sure that I was reviewing my notes. And I was on the bus, and I was knitting the whole time, and the color happened to be green. That was just because it was. I mean, it wasn't like a statement to knit something green. But I remember feeling like I had to hide that because we'd get to these stops, and they'd get on the bus, and it was often young people serving in, you know, their obligatory military service, but coming on with these, like, huge automatic weapons. And, you know, it's growing up in a community and running an organization in a community where guns have taken the lives of people that I love. I remember just feeling, you know, sort of, what does it mean to have your young people walking around with, like, Uzis hanging from their necks? And so I remember this young person got on, and it was an Israeli color. And so everybody's, like, pulling out their passport. And as I got off, you know, I just sort of said to myself, because they were checking, because, you know, the highways are separated. This is less the case now because it's just so much less freedom of movement for Palestinians that the highways are actually less regulated than they used to be. But I had this moment when I said to myself, how can I, as a Black woman, be sitting on a segregated highway built by survivors of the Holocaust? And it just felt so wrong. And so I came back, and I remember I had to write my final paper, and I, like, couldn't get myself to write it. And finally, I was like, I have to graduate. I have to finish this paper. And I literally cried my way through most of the writing. And I think it came at that point that I've struggled around nationalism as an idea, even within my own context in terms of Black nationalism. And I feel like that first trip was when I came to the clear conclusion that nationalism as an ideology is bankrupt no matter what epithet you put before it. And so Zionism, which is just Jewish nationalism, is not something I can support. And so that trip was, you know, really challenging. So when I got another offer, I was like, I don't know if I want to go through that again emotionally. But part of the reason I went is because this trip focused on the water crisis, which is something as a person who works on ecology, has been moving in my life. Like, it just feels like it keeps bringing, the spirit keeps bringing it up in different sets of settings. I was out in Standing Rock in 2016 and really identified with the notion of water as life. There, I say this to my congregation all the time when we joke about it. Like, I carry in my bag almost always a water bottle and my phone. But our tendency is, if you forget your water bottle, you go, okay, you know, I'll find something somewhere else. But if you forget your phone, I don't know about you, I will go back home to get my phone. And this recognition that we as a society have come to a place where we have lost touch with what really matters. Because if I don't have my phone, it feels like I won't make it, but the truth is that I will keep breathing and I will keep living. But if I don't have water, even for 3 days, I may die. And so this question of at what price came up again on this trip. You know, the water crisis is very real, not just in Israel. The water crisis is real in Syria. The water crisis is real in Southern Africa. The water crisis is real in Flint, Michigan, which is where I was visiting with a pastor, a friend there, and preaching there last summer. And so I think we kept hearing about water, about the role that water was playing, about the lack of water and how it was causing people to have to leave. I spent some time having some conversations with Palestinian Christians, many of whom have left at this point because they do have a slightly easier time getting visas and life has gotten so bad. And sort of the irony of seeing all these Christian pilgrims like walking around with no context for what they were seeing. And so you're like at you're at Bethlehem Square and you're taking pictures and behind you there's a settlement, which people don't even know is a settlement. People have no context in Jerusalem. And that was really challenging for me because even when I entered, I was like, I'm here, I'm Christian. I wore my I was in my full clergy gear. And they were like, oh, okay, yeah, great, so glad you're here. This question of the larger context of what we're facing. And for me, this crisis is not just about Israel and Palestine, but it has been demonstrated in such a powerful way. And I think the place I was most impacted was in Jericho, because I know that Jericho is one of those early places that human beings settled. The belief is that people have been in Jericho as long as 8,000 years. And the reason that they came was because water was so plentiful there. That our ancestors have known that water is the source of life long before we, had MacBooks and a lot of other things that have made us lose our sense of context. And so as we went to the spring that you would see, it literally, I Googled it to see what it had looked like before, and it just looked majestic. And it was almost impossible to believe that what I was seeing on this picture was where I was standing. And then I remember hearing about Israel's plan for the Jordan River, the plan to just move all this water redirect. It's like, how do you redirect an entire river? And I had the opportunity to swim in the Dead Sea, which is more accurately called the Dead Pond at this point. And I had this moment of what hubris allows you to believe. So for me, from a God perspective, that if God made it this way thousands, millions of years ago, you have the right to just send it in another direction because that's better for your development plans. And that hubris is not just in Israel. I deal with that hubris every day in the United States and all around the world. But it feels like they are reaching such a crisis point. For those of us who know anything about aquifers, they don't replenish quickly. It's not like if you just take them out and you get a couple good years of rain, the aquifer replenishes. It takes thousands of years for water to get to that aquifer. The idea that you could just strip it away so quickly and it's all going to work out, it just seemed absolutely ludicrous to me. And so I look at, in my life and in my work, what we as human beings need to do to turn away from the way that we're living into a way that is ultimately sustainable. And what you see in Israel and Palestine is one of the most accelerated versions of the deep connection between ecological devastation, human suffering, and just sheer human greed and folly. This literally can't work. You cannot box people more and more and more in and think they won't resist. There's something about the human spirit you cannot quench no matter how many development plans you put together. So I know we're going to have time for questions, and I know we're a little behind them. The one other story that I wanted to share was going to Hebron, which I had been to in 2015. It was probably the worst or most, you know, sort of emotionally challenging part of the trip in 2015. And then I went back and found that it was even worse the second time. When we had gone before, we were able to visit the woman whose house was, in order to sort of prevent violence and for security reasons, whole sections of Palestinian communities have been shut down so that you can create a corridor of access to the synagogue. When the synagogue is one part of what was 100% a mosque is now, you know, split. I can't remember what the percentage is of who has what, but it's split. And we met with a woman who had owned a space on that street that had been shut down, and she talked about how it used to be a great shop space because when everybody got out of prayers on Friday, they all had to walk past you, and you'd see people, and you'd sort of wave. And so she had been shut down. And when we got there, it was, you know, sort of just boarded up or closed, and people had grates that were coming down. When we got there this past year, those same spaces had been occupied by settlers who had sort of renamed, like put banners over their houses or over the shops and sort of taken over them. And then there were military people there to, like, you know, protect them for having taken this land. And where I think my heart was most deeply broken in Hebron was, so we went around, we saw the shops, we talked to people, we saw the sort of bottles of pee that were thrown over by the settlers. You can see them. They're still there. Sometimes they don't all pour onto people. So you can sort of see them hanging there. As we went deeper in, we saw more and more places that had been shut down, some places that had been opened when I had been there the last time and are no longer open at this point. And it was October, November, and I knew that we had just passed the Jewish holiday of Sukkot, which I have tended to participate in because it's a holiday where you celebrate the harvest and you celebrate nature and you create a structure that you sit outside under branches and have dinner and are sort of in community with folks. So all these places have been shut down, and one of the ways to make sure they stayed shut down was to throw trash into the alleys, because if you put the trash there, nobody's going to come by to shop. When I looked down, I saw tons and tons of branches, the kind that I know of, you put over the school houses. And I said, when did these come? He said, like late September. And I said, oh God, how could you celebrate a time that's about the harvest, about God's provision, and then use those branches to clutter the street of another group of folks? And so the role of religion, the role of, you know, sort of this sense that God has given me X and therefore has dispossessed you of Y. And for me, part of that is, although as a Black Christian, I was not really deeply, my particular ancestors were not deeply engaged in it, but the whole recognition that Christianity did that to Jewish people who then turned around did that to Muslim people, and sort of how this cycle of oppression in the name of God continues in such terrible ways. So those are my experiences, the things that, you know, sort of really stood out to me, and I know that we're going to engage in some dialogue, so I'll stop there and participate in the conversation. Thank you.
Yeah. So this is a Q&A portion. I'm going to ask one question, then we'll move to the audience for questions, and we'll try and keep things, you know, moving to be respectful of time. I ask that when you're thinking about questions, you make sure it's a question, because, you know, we all have a lot going on, right? And I don't care if you're an AIPAC plant or the most fervent Palestinian supporter. Please just make sure it's a question, okay? So with that, I actually wanted to touch on something Nancy mentioned, where you described something in one of the squares as, tasteful shows of occupation, right, with the towers. Were there other examples that you can think of with that same, in that same framework, right, where the colonization and occupation had sort of been beautified for the poem of the colonists? And let's see what Mike's work and which don't.
Does this one?
Yes. Yes.
You know, I was struck by that because it hadn't been there when I was there before, which was only 2 years before. And the whole of that Damascus Gate had been so transformed and sanitized. And I've never seen one of those mini towers anywhere else. Usually they just bang up one of those huge, horrendous looking, you know, you saw slides of them, giant towers. So, no, that was the only instance. But the reason it is, you know, sometime when I've been to Jerusalem, well, it's not, thanks. Sometime when I've been to Jerusalem in the past, there have been no tourists because, you know, there's been so conflict going on, no tourists. This time, there were tons of tourists. And I think now Israel is prepared for normality, the new normal. And so it's beautified that. And there were so many, what you said about the Christians walking around not having a clue, so many people taking selfies of themselves with Damascus Gate. It just wouldn't look good to have a big tower, so they shrunk it.
Hi, does this work? Yeah. All right, yeah. So I'm Chance, I'm a member of the BU SJP. I really liked how the presentation talked about different forms of Palestinian resistance. So I was wondering, we're seeing more and more open violence from both the Israeli state and from settlers against the Palestinians right now. There's a lot of examples of this happening. So I was wondering what more your views on Palestinian self-defense and the organization of that self-defense, if you had seen any of that in your trip or in previous trips, and your views on it more broadly, because often the Israeli state calls it Arab terrorism or violence or whatever, when really they're fighting back against, you know, settlers. So, yeah, just your thoughts on that.
Should I just say, I mean, over the years when I have had trips, I have encountered it right in front of me, various efforts to, you know, stone throwing is the most common expression of Palestinians saying, you know, we will not give up. We are here, you leave. And I've been in these demonstrations at Berlin and Narisala where there, you know, might be some stone throwing. But generally, the demonstrations that I have participated in there have been United Civil Society Nonviolent Protests. And that has a long history in Palestine, going way back to the 30s. I mean, it's nothing new. So, you know, I have seen in the Gaza Strip, I've actually seen, you know, the kind of protests, I've seen armed resistance. But we didn't see anything like that now. It was, you know, I must say, it was the last time I had been there, it was the so-called knife intifada, and people were, you know, a real act of nihilistic despair. Going out, a lot of times people were getting killed because it was said they had a knife, but there wasn't a knife, and this is familiar, when something gets planted, you know, after right. The person is just shot down. But there were cases where, you know, young people, how much can you endure these pressure cooker situations? And sometimes, you know, they would have a knife and just be holding it and get killed. But self-defense, organized self-defense, you know, they don't have it anymore in the West Bank with weapons because, among other things, the PA has got a very highly trained by America force, which is used, yeah, the Palestinian Authority, which is used to basically undergird the occupation and prevent any kind of protest, which is one of the really depressing things.
I mean, I had an opportunity to talk with someone about this specifically, and I mean, one of the things I just said is strategically, it just doesn't make sense. Like, that was their assessment, that arguing over philosophically whether it was right or not, like, if you were to do it, it would literally just give people, like, even the idea, like, that you might be doing it can be used as a justification. And so that was, you know, actually somebody else asked the question, and he was like, we could talk about it, we can argue about it philosophically, but from a strategic perspective, it just didn't make sense. And I didn't see anyone else who, like, even at least one other person that I thought, like, who had had a similar, like, assessment. So I just didn't see it anywhere that people were like, oh, that's going to be a viable way to make a difference.
Yeah, just before we move on, I just remembered, I was there during the Second Intifada on a couple of occasions when you would see somebody with a gun, right, who was maybe shooting in the direction of Gilo Settlement from Bethlehem, and then you would see these missiles fired at that person and just have them blown away. The inequality of force is so huge. And, you know, it's a bit like the United States in Yemen now. Think of what we're doing in Yemen. And that is what Israel is doing. And in the Gaza Strip, you're in that tiny area and you have drones flying constantly overhead. You hear the zzzz all the time. And they are watching everything. And then they just shoot missiles down whenever they feel like it. So how can you?
Yeah.
I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and I think one of the other things is that people see media as one of the most powerful forms of defense and one of the most powerful forms. And so if you can demonstrate that people are just literally being attacked with no weapons, the idea is that actually has more ability to move people onto their side, because everybody we said was like, it's not going to just work out between Israel and Palestine. It will require an international movement of solidarity to make this work.
So just to add that, I'm hidden behind you. just to reinforce the points that have been made, I mean, violent resistance, you're at a severe competitive disadvantage with the occupying force. So I think, you know, one of the points of BDS is that, you know, this is non-violent resistance, and it calls attention, you know, it has called attention in this country to the injustices going on. And, you know, the theme of agricultural resistance, cultural resistance that I was talking about, you know, is people just getting up every day is a form of resistance, and actually getting on with their lives is a form of resistance. And, you know, when I came back, I was speaking to somebody who didn't know much about the subject at all and said, well, did you meet any violence? And I said, actually, no. The only violence that we came across was arguing about who was going to pay the bill in the restaurant we were living. You know, so that was it.
Maintaining the same theme, I'm just wondering how we feel about Hamas and Hezbollah and whether we think they're freedom fighters or they're terrorists.
Well, I'm not going to speak about Hezbollah because it's not really germane. In the case of Hamas, Hamas is part of Palestinian society. It, you know, people just think Hamas, armed struggle. Hamas has got a huge social welfare program. Sarah Roy, who is a local Harvard professor, has written more than, I think she's the foremost scholar of what's happened in Gaza, that she's wrote the development of Gaza. But also she's written several books on Hamas. So, you know, I don't think, you know, Hamas is fighting for its own version of Palestinian liberation. Now, it has been very, very good at maintaining its side of bargains. When it enters into a truce, it's not Hamas which breaks it, it's Israel which breaks it. You know, personally, I would rather Hamas were not in charge, just because I remember Gaza when it didn't have so much rules and regulations, you know, governing women and so forth. But, you know, people there supported it because they felt Fatah was so corrupt and not listening to them. And so they voted in 2006 in an election that Jimmy Carter was monitoring, and he said was fully fair and democratic. And that brought Hamas a legislative majority. And what Israel then did, and the United States then did, was backed a coup attempt by Fatah to defeat Hamas. It was very nasty, very violent, but very short. And what ended up happening is Hamas took charge of the government because of that attempt to overthrow the results of a democratic election. So it's a complex situation. I don't want to just say Hamas is this or Hamas is that. It is clear, though, that it is part of the Palestinian fabric.
Can I just add to that, just to say that Hamas is also not the sole leader of the March of Return. March of Return is a civilly organized march, and that action has been organized by civil society. And because the U.S. press says it's Hamas, and it's not.
No.
So, I mean, Hamas is part of it as well, but it was not organized. I just wanted to say that.
That is very clear. I mean, it was organized by people through the social media, including the person who was just here, Ahmed Abu Artima, who is not Hamas.
Hi. Oh, that's very loud. Thank you so much for the SGP for hosting us tonight, and for the three of you for this very detailed and clear presentation. With what's going on the ground in Palestine, Israel, with the new election, and how Israel allowing Kahana movement to enter the election, which Kahana, you know, holds the slogan of erasing any non-Jews in Palestine. And with the political environment in the U.S., which we witnessed by both parties, the Republicans and recently the Democrats, with in response to Ilhan Omar, we all know that the future or the upcoming year or two in Palestine is going to be like much harder on the ground. What do you think, what kind of reactions, organizations, work needs to be done from here, from the U.S., not only to react to an action or to an event or to a war on Gaza, but to really to be strategically done to confront these challenges?
So I would say one of the things that I think is actually, so this is not the way I would have wanted to come, but one of the things I think is happening is it is actually making a lot of folks who have traditionally supported Israel ask some deep questions about whether or not they should continue supporting it. I think the reality is, and I think this, I say from a spiritual perspective, if you allow things to fester, they fester, right? And so I think people have dismissed, even with Netanyahu, some of his things in the past, and now it's getting really clear how bad it is. The same way that I think, you know, I certainly would not have asked for Trump, but I think it actually is causing us to have some deep conversations that we should have been having, we could have been having 10 years ago or 20 years ago, but we are having them because he makes it so crystal clear how all of these oppressions are connected. I mean, he does it in a way that I'm not sure, I'm not sure the material conditions would have been like hugely different if a Democrat would have won. There's some things that we've been struggling with for centuries, but he makes it so clear that we have a long way to go. So I think that is the extremeness of it is actually forcing a conversation that I'm not sure would have been had without that. On the other hand, I think that there's going to be pain and suffering. The same way that folks are struggling and suffering at the border in the United States, I think people are going to be suffering in Palestine as a result of it. And I'm not sure that folks can do much more than continue on the path of sort of nonviolent resistance. I mean, I'm not sure what they can do other than organize. I really actually believe the reckoning with this is really a conversation with Israeli society about like how far this has come. And there are deep divisions within Israeli society. And I think it's making people ask these questions in a tougher way. Like one of the things I looked at that I thought was really powerful is when you look at early on in early Zionism, there were folks who were pro-Zionist, there were folks who were totally against Zionism, there were folks who were in the middle, but the folks who were pro kept being like recruiting people. So even if that at the beginning, if it was like 10, 10 and, or, you know, 30%, 30% and 30%, whatever, if the other group keeps bringing more people in, like your percentage is going to decline. And I think by, as I would call forcing it, like pushing the envelope so far, I think it may offer greater hope for some folks to have to face some things that were already in existence, but they're now being put in people's face in such an obvious way that they can't ignore them.
I have another question.
Okay, we can talk more later.
So we'll do one more question, just to respect your time. I'll pop. I've done all men, so I'm going to do one woman. I'm so sorry. So I'll pop over here in 2 seconds. I wanted to let you all know there's tons of handouts and everything up here. I don't know who got what. But there's a World Water Day standout on March 22nd, which is on BU Bridge. Pop
yes,
over that. Yeah, we'll all be there. Then on
4:30 in the afternoon.
4:30 in the afternoon, so not nighttime. So there's that. There's a ton of other events, but there's also the Walk for Water on May 5th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Both the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine and BUSJP have teams.
May 4th.
I'm so sorry. It's May 4th. It's also on Facebook, so pop over there too. All right, last question.
I hope it's okay to ask this. It's a little bit off, but sort of part of what I thought was going to be talked about. I'm curious about the intersectionality of environmental issues with the political issues in Israel-Palestine, and if anybody feels like they would like to say a little bit about what is projected for the environment in Israel-Palestine, and what effect and how does that interact with the political struggle?
So I mentioned this quickly, but I can talk more specifically. I should have pulled up the numbers, but many of the aquifers are at like a critical place, right? And there's been some of them have been in use for years and were already depleting, which is why in the last, I think it's 5 years, there's been all this tapping going down even lower, trying to find, you know, more remote sources of water. But the estimate I got from one person is that in the next 10 years, even if you kept the population stable at the number it is right now, and so let me just be clear, there have been water crises before, right? There have been times where people were asked to go without water, even in some instances in Israel. And now they're reaching a place where in the next 10 years, there's no way the water could sustain them, especially with the growth projections that people are putting forward. So this question becomes, where will you get water from? There is some investment or some looking at desalinization plants as an option, but desalinization is very expensive. So how that's going to be done and how it's going to be done on a level that could sustain such a large population. So the reality is, I'll say this from not just this perspective, but in general, I actually believe that water and the climate crisis is the most likely thing to lead to the collapse of some of our most problematic systems. The big question is, are we ready to imagine the alternative? Because if systems collapse, one of three things can happen. Either the folks who have already been in power adjust and figure out how to make it work, or folks who knew it wasn't working propose an alternative and people are more open to that alternative because the system is obviously collapsed, or the collapse is so profound that we lose all semblance of order in the society. The way that they are living there and the way we are living here and the way people are living, we are pushing ourselves to the possibility that the third category is the only option.
Because if everyone around is taxing their water at rates that are not sustainable, where do you even go? And so I would say the water crisis there has the possibility to be the straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of that situation.
I would like to give a more hopeful response to that. Because what I mean, the examples that we showed, you know, so for instance, in Benin and the Om Sleiman farm, so, you know, starting a community supported agriculture thing, even though it's on a fairly modest basis, you know, there are 30 families involved. What is coming out of these privations is people organizing themselves to create what they can within their own sphere of power as a resistance to the oppression, but also as a sort of, to put it in Marxist terms, prefigurative form of what they want the society to be, i.e. to be working cooperatively to create their own food supply and not be dependent on American or Israeli corporations, for instance, or NGOs for that matter. And, you know, so, and the cooperative that we went around in Canaan was a similar example, you know, of farmers getting together, farmers who are living on the margins, but getting together so that they can invest cooperatively in the machinery that does all the olive pressing and the distribution and forming distribution networks. You know, these are, you know, out of this privation is coming some real creative organizing. And, you know, it's on the environmental side, on the water side, you know, there is a huge amount of pressure. But the roof gardens in we saw in Ida Camp, you know, are an example of people really tending their food, their growing of their food, and watering their food in a very disciplined manner. Not this sort of mass irrigation that you see, which is so depleting of the aquifers. You know, these are all promising developments. Whether they are on a scale large enough to, you know, really redress the massive depredation that is going on is another matter. But, you know, I don't want you to be hopeless.
I would just want to say, yes, I believe it's beautiful Palestinians are finding ways to survive, yeah. But most Israelis live the way we do and have built their whole society around a form of water that's not viable.
Let me just say that, in fact, water, the breakdown, which is in the Gaza Strip happening, it's becoming unlivable, it is unlivable, may be what forces Israel to change. And I'll give you one example. Because they have just been dumping raw sewage at a huge rate, they have no other way of treating it, into the Mediterranean. That has now been brought up to Ashkelon, where the biggest desalination plant is in Israel. And it clogs the plant. And then you get these articles in the press saying, oh, poor us, maybe we have to do something about this. Likewise, because the Gaza Strip has no medicine, there's giant number of injured people because of 20,000 in this great march. And they're getting terrible, terrible infections that have that superbug quality, and they have no antibiotics to deal with it. Then you have Israel saying, oh dear, this could spread to us. We better maybe take this on board. So there could be a kind of roundabout way of all these terrible things that are going on finally forcing Israel to face what it's doing. That's optimism.
That was part two of the report back of their Palestinian trip by Nancy and Hubert Murray and Mariama White Hammond. Before we go, I want to give an update on the continuing assault by the Israeli lobby on campus groups who stand in support of Palestinian liberation, and in particular, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Campaign, BDS. Recently, there have been provocations on two campuses, Swarthmore on the East Coast and Pitzer in the West. The outside pressure on groups at Swarthmore has been so intense that it fostered the following letter of support from a number of educators and activists throughout the country. They wrote, "We, the undersigned, affirm our unequivocal support for Swarthmore Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP, and their Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS, campaign at Swarthmore College. This past month, student organizers at Swarthmore have faced targeted online harassment from right-wing social media accounts for their work in solidarity with Palestine. This harassment is not happening in isolation and is no accident. Rather, it is part of a deliberate strategy we see on campuses across the country to intimidate and silence those who organize in support of Palestinian lives and dignity. While Islamophobia, white supremacy, anti-Semitism, and all forms of injustice are on the rise across the country and the world and must be vigorously challenged, we deplore these tactics that target movements for justice falsely and maliciously, accusing those organizing for justice in Palestine with anti-Semitism. Indeed, we know that this harassment happening at Swarthmore and other college campuses across the country is not really about rallying against the rising tide of anti-Semitism. In fact, this kind of unethical behavior does a disservice to the effort to challenge anti-Semitism when it does arise. We also know that this intimidation disproportionately and deliberately targets Palestinians, black, indigenous, and Muslim communities. Above all, we know that this intimidation will not stop the students at Swarthmore, on colleges across the country, or any of us from continuing to organize together as a movement for justice and dignity for all peoples. To the students at Swarthmore and to all students on campuses across the United States, we seek a more just world, and we've got your back." Among the long list of signers is Angela Davis, Nora Erekat, Rashid Khalidi, Stephen Saleta, Rebecca Vilcomerson, Linda Sarsour, and Rabbi Brant Rosen. The Pitzer conflict is summarized in the following Mondo Weiss report, and I'm quoting the report. "Pitzer College's Governing Council took an historic vote to suspend a program of study at the University of Haifa because of Israel's discriminatory policies. And just 3 hours later, that resolution was vetoed emphatically by the college president. President Melvin Oliver's veto is now roiling the small progressive college in Claremont, California. Pitzer presidents have never vetoed a college council resolution before. Pitzer prides itself on the democratic governance, giving students a voice in school policies. The vote to suspend the program was overwhelming, 67-28, and the voters comprised nearly 60 faculty, about 35 students, and some 10 staff. Many are reportedly angry about the veto, and students have circulated a petition condemning Oliver that has gotten several hundred signatures nationwide, some with real throw weight. The resolution said the college should not work in countries with policies that restrict entry on the basis of either A, legally protected political speech, or B, race or ancestry. It cited Israeli policies scrutinizing visitors of Palestinian ancestry and barring those who support Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS. The resolution has wide support from the Palestinian Solidarity Community. Congressional Representative Rashida Tlaib of Michigan expresses support for the Pitzer College resolution to end the Haifa University program. "President Oliver's swift veto statement justifying his move is very interesting. It is tempting to read donors into his comment that he discussed the matter with faculty, trustees, students, parents, and a range of other constituents. After all, donors always play a role in these scandals. But the more significant comments from Oliver contain near rage that the measure is on the progressive fringe and will give Pitzer a bad reputation for embracing a campaign that the liberal mainstream regards as anti-Semitic. Look at the fear in these remarks by President Oliver, and I'm quoting. Some will say I am taking my own position on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in choosing not to implement the recommendation of the College Council. I am not. Instead, I am refusing to permit Pitzer College to take a position that I believe will only harm the college. Unquote. Oliver all but says the measure is anti-Semitic, or people will think it is. Quoting again from Oliver, by singling out Israel, the recommendation itself is prejudiced. The reputational harm to the college would be irreparable, and as president of this institution, I cannot permit this to happen, unquote. The national climate in which leading Democrats have maligned BDS surely affected Oliver, says Daniel Siegel, the history and anthropology professor, who has been the leader of the initiative to end the program. If there's one radical issue that's even more taboo than any other, it is this. But Oliver's putting his finger in the wind won't go down well with the Pitzer faculty and student body. The Students for Justice in Palestine chapter that Dan Siegel advises has pushed the question again and again. Leading Pitzer faculty joined Siegel to back the suspension, and the faculty's executive committee is angered by Oliver's failure to follow procedure by consulting with it before he issued his veto. Oliver's veto would seem to represent the mainstream's angry rejection of the progressive left in American life in this issue. The divide we see at every level and among Jews. The opposition to the resolution was led by older Jewish faculty, but younger Jewish faculty spearheaded the resolution, and more Jewish students are joining Muslims and Arabs and Students for Just Palestine, says Siegel. Israel-Palestine is now at the center of the school's concerns. It has gotten there through years of activist organizing. Many students and faculty were compelled to explore the question in their belief that they could play a part in making school policy. Now they've been rejected. Students have circulated a petition condemning the veto, and some are evidently considering taking a no-confidence vote on President Oliver's leadership. Pitzer represents the edge of progressive institutional discourse on Israel-Palestine. The battle line right now, when only two members of Congress can say they support BDS. The good news is that the desire to end the relationship with the University of Haifa has not gone away, and many on the California campus have come to see Israel's discriminatory practices as their cause. That was a report from Mondo Weiss, and that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.